to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. My name is Camden Busey. I'm back in Grays Lake, Illinois, after a little bit of time off. Not time off in terms of recording time, but for me, I've been out for a little bit, and happy to be back to have an excellent conversation. I've been reading this book, ruminating over these things, meditating on these issues, and it couldn't come at a better time, I think, a much-needed time in our culture. As we welcome today, Dr. Carl Truman, who serves as a professor of biblical and religious studies at Grove City College. He's written many books, and we've had him on the program many, many times in the past. Of course, he's a ministerial member of the Orthodox Presbyterian Church. Welcome back, Carl. It's good to see you today.
Hey, it's great to be back, Cameron. Good to see you, too.
Yes, I'm glad that we're able to connect. You know how things are going. We talked a couple of years ago, maybe just a year and a half ago. I can't even remember, but you were kind enough to come out, and we picked you up at the airport in Milwaukee as you came to, that would have been 2017. It had to have been, because it was the 500th anniversary of the Reformation. You came to speak on Luther to our presbytery. We met at Cedar Grove, Wisconsin. And it was at that time that we were talking about a project that you were working on while you were working on a fellowship at Princeton University. And that's what we're going to be speaking about today, this wonderful new book, The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self, Cultural Amnesia, Expressive Individualism, and the Road to Sexual Revolution. It's published by Crossway. They've done a fine job. I've had an advanced reader's copy PDF for several months now, and I've finished it, been working through it. So I don't have a hard copy to hold up and show to you, but I think they're being treated as gold anyway. So even if I had one, someone might be breaking my door down. This is such a critical and important book. I'm excited to talk about it today. Carl, I should just start off by kind of asking you the real important question, like, what's going on with this world and why the need for such a book? I suppose you should give us a little bit of the history. Explain to us your time at Princeton and what gave rise to your interest in this subject.
Yeah, well, the book has a slightly odd origin, and it began with a conversation, or sort of twofold conversation, with Rod Dreher, the senior editor at the American Conservative, who's actually an Orthodox Christian, not an Orthodox Presbyterian Christian, just an Orthodox Christian.
Yeah, he's a real Orthodox.
And, yeah, real Eastern Orthodox.
He's the kind of Orthodox everyone else thinks we are. When they
yes,
visit.
Exactly. But we don't have the great beards and the...
I'm working on it. Yeah.
But Rod Dreher, and also Justin Taylor at Crossway. Rod was wondering if somebody would write an introduction to the thought of this guy, Philip Reeve, who famously wrote this book, The Triumph of the Therapeutic, in the 1960s. Wanted somebody to do something akin to Reeve that Jamie Smith did relative to Charles Taylor in A Secular Age with his How Not to Be Secular book. And Justin picked up on this, and Rod and myself and Justin got talking. And I sort of said, sure, I'd be happy to look at seeing if something like that was viable. So I went away and started to read up Reeve. I think this was 2015. And as I was working on Reeve and getting more and more into what he was writing, it became evident to me that the kinds of categories that he was using and the sort of analysis he was proposing could be more interestingly studied by applying it to today. So the project morphed from being an introduction to Reeve to a kind of application of Reeve's ideas to the world of today. Around about the same time, of course, Obergefell versus Hodges went down on the gay marriage issue at the Supreme Court. We had Bruce/Caitlyn Jenner come out as a transgender person. So sexual politics was really hitting all the headlines. And so I decided it would be useful to broaden the project and to see about writing a cultural analysis that would help Christians to understand why so many unquestioned orthodoxies of the past, marriage, sex/gender, etc., were falling so rapidly. And that was the sort of the origin of this project. And then I was greatly blessed to get a James Madison Fellowship at Princeton University. It's a great program run by wonderful professors Robbie George and Brad Wilson. It's a way for professors, often from smaller colleges, to spend a year at Princeton University working on a particular project that's considered by them to be of interest to the public good. And I'm always going to be very grateful to the Madison program for supporting me and giving me that year where I was able to get most of the reading done. When I left the Madison program, I went to Grove and got the book written really in my first year at Grove. Mm-hmm. So that's the sort of the nuts and bolts of how the book came about.
Sure. I think it's structured really well, you know, in my employment, you know, I have to read a lot of books. I have to read them quickly, talking often about a new book every week. I always love reading your books. Number one, because I appreciate your prose style. It's always, insightful, witty, and structured well. But the one thing I really appreciated about this book was indeed the structure. It's very clearly defined, and you're working through a building a case throughout the entire book, but in four parts. And the way you laid it out is very helpful. Now, as people are going to come to find this book, number one, would encourage everybody who listens to this program for sure to get a copy. I don't do that with every book that we review or discuss, but I think this is one that everyone needs to have, whether you read every word of it or not. Will be up to you. In many ways, I found this to be a work of, you know, the history of continental philosophy in one sense. And I can't imagine that you necessarily started off thinking that way. And I mentioned that not to scare people away that, well, I'm not a philosopher. I don't like continental philosophy. But what you've done is a helpful service to the church as an historian to uncover this history of ideas and demonstrate that indeed these ideas do have consequences. And what we're seeing today with this crisis of identity, where we really can't even say whether someone is male or female, because that would be dependent on what they determine themselves. These questions you mentioned that would have been utter nonsense to your grandfather are now very commonplace and the norm on television and in the culture. How did this work morph in that way? I mean, did you ever envision yourself becoming a continental philosopher of sorts?
No, I say on my Grove City College website, somebody pointed out to me yesterday when they asked me about reading habits. And I say, I'm a very undisciplined reader. I just read whatever that interests me, which means I've read a whole lot about a whole lot of stuff, but I've never really settled in any major area.
Even on the philosophy of wine, that was one of your recommendations to me. So you're into all the philosophies.
I love Roger Scruton and his book, I Drink, Therefore I Am.
Yeah.
Not for Baptists, but for Presbyterians, I think, is a wonderful, wonderful book. Now, the structure actually took me as hard to work out the structure as anything, because this story, in some ways, it's like an octopus. I had, during my year in Princeton, I had dinner with an old friend, Gordon Graham, who we were colleagues at Aberdeen many years ago, and he was latterly professor of philosophy at Princeton Seminary. And we had dinner and I was outlining the project to him, and his comment to me was, it's going to be impossible to pull that together. That's an octopus. And so I really struggled with the structure, and I'm very grateful to Grove, to the Institute of Faith and Freedom at Grove, for providing me with a research assistant, a final year student at whom I was able to throw my stuff and ask her, does it make sense? How do I fit this together? So the structure was hard, but it was a team effort, myself and Kirsten, my research assistant, sort of worked on that. My bottom line was I wanted that sentence, I'm a woman trapped in a man's body. Mm-hmm. What do I have to use sort of language that I know you would love, Camden, what do I have to presuppose as true in order for that to be,
amen,
to make sense? What does the culture have to imagine about reality for that sentence to be plausible? My grandfather would regard it as nonsense. And I identified a number of things as I reflected on that. Well, you've got to separate your identity from your embodiment, really. Mm-hmm. You've got to psychologize your identity. You've got to separate biological sex from gender. There are all kinds of things that have got to come into play. You have to understand the purpose of your life as something that you determine. It's not something that is placed upon you from outside. And it was with those things in mind, I said, okay, well, I've really got to trace. How does identity get psychologized? How does psychology get sexualized? Mm-hmm. And how does sex get politicized? And
absolutely,
that was the kind of the three phases of the history that I saw with Rousseau and the Romantics, you get the psychologizing of identity. With Freud, you get the sexualizing of psychology. And then in the 20th century, you get the politicizing of sex. That was the kind of the main spine of the narrative. There are other narratives as well. I got into a little bit of trouble with this with the students actually at Grove when, you know, I regard Hugh Hefner as rather key to the narrative because of all people, he's the guy who popularizes pornography. He's mm-hmm. the guy who popularizes the idea that human satisfaction is found sexually. He's a popularizer of Freud in many ways. And more people will have looked at Playboy than have read Freud.
Sure.
I did refer to Hefner as a genius in class, and that was taken as a point of approbation. I didn't mean he was a great guy. I meant that he was very clever in how he marketed this stuff.
Yeah, and his thought and ideas were seminal for others. In that sense of genius, I suppose.
Because you always have to, there's always that story of how do these ideas that intellectuals think, mm-hmm. how do they become the common currency of how ordinary people intuit the world around them? And it's often a complicated story.
Oh, it is, absolutely. And that's what I want to reiterate to folks. You know, the people that have read philosophy will certainly enjoy this. I've read a good bit. I haven't read a ton. I wouldn't call myself a philosopher in that sense, but I've had PhD courses in continental philosophy, etc. I read it. I prefer it much to the analytic because I think the ideas actually have effects on the world.
Yes, it's asking bigger questions.
It is.
It's asking bigger questions.
My joke, maybe I stole this from somebody, I can't remember, but I'm going to take credit for it one way or the other. The issue with continental philosophy is they ask enormous questions and can't come up with any real solid answer. But the problem with the analytics is they have such a narrow question that they get a hyper-precise and exhaustive answer, but it doesn't mean anything because it's... doesn't apply to the world anymore.
That's a great way of putting it, yes.
And so, you know, I tend toward the continental side, but we see the effects here. So the importance here is that even if you don't have any familiarity with continental philosophy, I think of the folks in my church, and most of them will not have read, let alone heard of most of the figures addressed in this book. Nevertheless, what you end up finding is that when you're reading this and you start to read on how these ideas were introduced and developed and then passed to the next generation and somebody picked up someone's idea, transmuted it, adjusted it, moved it on, through this history of ideas, we come to make sense out of our present context and situation. And that's the value, I think, of this book, because we're left just looking at the news. How did this become this way? Like you alluded with the presuppositions, or we might even ask, what are the necessary preconditions of this society or culture that would allow for an idea like this to be heard, not just heard, but adopted? And that's where you've really uncovered the layers of the onion of these odd ideas over the centuries. And I don't know if anyone else really could do it quite the way you did, but I do think you cracked the code. You've done a fine job.
Well, thanks very much. That's very kind. And I mean, one of the other things I try to do as well is to demonstrate that the things that often we see in isolation
right.
are all symptoms of an underlying change. I think that one of the reasons why Christians have been caught so off guard by aspects of the sexual revolution, you know, gay marriage seems so long ago and so passé now,
right.
given what we're facing with the transgender question. Christians have been caught off balance by the speed of things. Once you realize that actually these things are all connected mm-hmm. and they relate to changes that have been taking place in culture for several hundred years, it's both a sobering thing because we realize that the cultural task, if you like, is overwhelming at this point. But it's also helpful in knowing it's not total anarchy. There is a rationale behind it mm-hmm. that we can, as you put it, crack the code, which will hopefully allow us to be better prepared, less on the back foot as future developments and iterations mm-hmm. of this take place.
Absolutely. Well, let's get down into some of the parts and talk about some of these massive ideas and put them together. And this will no doubt add to the reading list of most of our listeners. I know I need to buy several of these books to get up to speed. But in part one, you've titled that part Architecture of the Revolution. But there you're really seeking to lay out the basic concepts that you will explore later in this historical narrative, but you draw on three philosophers of the modern condition, Philip Reeve, Charles Taylor, and Alistair MacIntyre. Those names are huge, but nevertheless might not be, they're huge in the field. They might not be known to people on, yeah, in the wider culture. Can you explain some of the basic contributions of some of these folks and why it's important, why their ideas are particularly useful for explaining the architecture at work here?
Sure. Well, take Charles Taylor first. Charles Taylor, he's a sort of liberal Roman Catholic, Canadian philosopher. I find him very useful because he's done a lot of work on human selfhood, how we understand ourselves. I think he latches onto something very important in human nature, and that is we all want to be free, but we also want to belong. And he's very good at articulating how that plays out in history. There's a sense in which, you know, we want to be able to express ourselves, but self-expression is also often a social thing. Teenagers see their clothes as an expression of their inner self, and they all dress the same. It would be a sort of simple example.
Exactly.
And that I found this idea of what he calls expressive individualism set within the social context, I found very helpful for explaining, you know, why is it that there is this explosion, say, in kids wanting to be transgender at the moment? Is it that for thousands of years there have been all these transgender people around, but society has been so oppressive that they've never been able to express themselves? Or is it more complicated than that? Is it that society itself has formed recently in such a way that fluid gender identity is a way of belonging? It's become a desire, if you like, that we have. So Taylor's book I found very useful for understanding how notions of freedom, selfhood, and individuality play out in the social context. Reeve is, in some ways, I guess, the guiding light in the book. Reeve was, from what I can make, secular Jewish guy. For those interested in American intellectual life, he was for a while married to Susan Sontag, the famous feminist essayist and cultural critic. Reeve wrote a book in 1966 called The Triumph of the Therapeutic, where he argued that the hallmark of the modern era was an inner-directed therapy, that, you know, in the Middle Ages, for example, human beings, you were born, you'd been born into a medieval family, peasant farmers. The purpose of education, the purpose of you growing up was for you to learn the preordained role for you in the social structure and to be educated and adapted to that role. It says a shift takes place in the late 19th, early 20th century where really we no longer think of the world that way. We don't think of the world as a given into which we have to fit ourselves. We think of ourselves as individuals who need to be happy, who need to find an inner sense of psychological peace. And we do that by, you know, in the crudest sense, by demanding that the world conform to make us happy. An example of this might be child-centered education. You know, when I went to school, I told some of the kids at Grove this the other week. You know, they asked me, were you ever caned at school? I said, no, teacher did lift me up by the ears once. You know, and you look at the look of disbelief on these kids today. You say, well, of course, the education in those days was, I'm going to an institution to be institutionalized, you know.
Right.
Knock my individual out of me and make me a member of society.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, of course, everything is pressed on the individual is king, and society must conform to that. Reeve has a famous saying which captures this nicely when he says, "In the Middle Ages, people did not go to church to be made happy. They went to church to have their misery explained to them."
Oh, wow.
And of course, as OPC ministers, we're good on explaining misery, as you know.
Well, sure. And you, the Luther scholar, will certainly find that to be appealing.
That sort of captures, you know, how many of us go to church now for what it can do for us, for how it can cater to our needs, can provide us with the things that we need in order to feel happy, rather than being conformed to some larger reality and having that larger reality and the way it sometimes pinches us explained to us. So Reeve I found very useful for his his emphasis on what the psychologizing of the self had done culturally, how it had transformed our whole attitude to the world around. The third figure, Alistair McIntyre, is somewhat less important in the analysis, but McIntyre is good for his concept of what he calls emotivism, where his basic argument is, in the public sphere today, we have lost any agreed meta-narrative, any agreed overall story or foundation upon which to adjudicate moral discussion. So morality has come down to emotional preferences. You know, if I say I disagree with abortion, if I say abortion is wrong, what I'm really saying is I personally find abortion a distasteful concept. And that, I think, is useful for understanding, A, the breakdown of moral discourse in modern society, how the expressive individualism of Taylor, the therapeutic culture of Reef, manifests itself in these horribly polarized and totally fruitless ethical debates. Mm-hmm. And secondly, explains how often, for example, Christian moral positions will be understood by those who are not Christians. We see this in United States versus Windsor, the lawsuit that really sets the play up for Obergefell versus Hodges, the gay marriage
decision
lawsuit. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Windsor overthrew the Defense of Marriage Act. And in the opinion on Windsor, the Supreme Court essentially says that the only reason for opposing gay marriage is constitutional animus,
precisely,
irrational bigotry.
Precisely. Well, it's not enough nowadays to have a rational argument, but if you disagree, your position is not merely registered as disagreement, but as a phobia, or even worse, yes, as hatred. Yeah, that, yes, if you think that homosexuality is immoral, then you hate homosexual people.
Yeah, it has the same quality as racism. You know, to
right,
object to homosexual practice is to be the moral equivalent of a racist. So McIntyre, I found helpful, not so much for his positive ethical philosophy, though I think that has some merits, but really for his way of helping me understand, yeah, that's why things are so toxic now. And that is why, how people tend to think about moral disagreements, that they really come down to matters of taste, matters of bigotry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, nowadays people, this gets down to a deeper issue that's helpful for people that are, you know, struggling to find out what makes sense of our current cultural moment. But, you know, nowadays people often will think of sex as largely a recreational activity. Even that idea is not an appropriate idea, but that, you know, up until a certain point was thought of as what it was. It's just something you did for personal pleasure, enjoyment, yeah, whatever. But that's now something presented as that which lies at the very heart of what it means to be an authentic person. Sex is not just a behavior or an activity, but really who you are and how you express yourself in your most basic and fundamental identity.
Yes, I use the example in the book of the movie, The 40-Year-Old Virgin, that I've never seen, but I know it's a comedy.
Right.
Because I live in a culture where the idea of being, well, the world would say sexually inexperienced, I would say being sexually pure and chaste at 40 is ridiculous. That person must be inadequate in some way, must be unfulfilled. Their life is clearly not a rich one. And that really is, you know, takes us to the heart of what you've just said, that, yeah, sex is now considered to be fundamental to human fulfillment, sexual activity, fundamental to who we are, as opposed to the biblical view of sex. Now, I don't go with Augustine, you know, Augustine's view that there was no pleasure in sex before the fall strikes right, me as inherently unlikely. But clearly in the Bible, the tilt on the matter of sex is towards the satisfaction of the partner and the production of children. It's an outwardly directed thing. It's ultimately not about me. It's about others. And that's something that has been almost completely lost in our culture.
You know, just about a decade ago, it seemed like everything we were talking about in terms of the culture was this was wrapped around this word toleration or tolerance. And, you know, it wasn't, you shouldn't be intolerant. You need to be a tolerant people, tolerant culture. But where we are today in 2020 is that toleration isn't even good enough now. It's not enough for people merely to have legal protection or at least the personal liberty to do whatever they want sexually in the privacy of their own bedrooms or wherever with consenting parties, but they demand frequently approval. So how was that bound up with the, how does it explain, I should ask, the deeper issues of this dynamic with personal identity and the need and the demand for approval?
Yeah. Well, Taylor picks up on an idea from Hegel that I think is very useful here. Mm-hmm. Taylor talks about recognition. And there are a number of ways, you know, you can understand recognition in a sort of common sense way. Hey, Camden, I recognize you. Hey, good to see you. That's a sort of a thin understanding.
Right.
What Taylor's getting at is this idea that for me to be fully me, for me to be a fully self-conscious me, I need other self-consciousnesses. I need other people to acknowledge me as me.
And affirm you in that
and affirm
in that decision.
To acknowledge me, affirm me, et cetera, et cetera. So if I'm convinced that, you know, if I'm gay and I'm convinced that my same-sex desire is absolutely fundamental to my identity, for you to say, well, I don't want you sent to prison for that, Truman. I can tolerate that. What you're actually saying is, I'm not going to punish you for that, but I'm not going to recognize you either. I'm still going to deny your identity at a fundamental level. And that's not enough. I mean, that's why, you know, Christians can look on at the cake baker scenario or the florist scenario where they won't provide services for a gay wedding. And I think from a Christian perspective, we think of that in terms of, well, we can't do something that we feel would be sanctioning, you know, the mockery of a religious ceremony. Or we can't do something that would be sanctioning an action of which we don't approve. We're not campaigning to ban that action, but we ourselves cannot sanction it. The gay couple, of course, see it as our identities being denied. It is the equivalent of Jim Crow. It is the equivalent of racism to them.
Exactly.
Because recognition is being denied at that point. And that's why, you know, tolerance was a useful, I think, rhetorical stepping stone. But ultimately the game, as Darryl Paul in his excellent book, the title eludes me, but Darryl Paul's done a great book on this. I think From Tolerance to Equality, I think is the title of it, where he looks at how this dynamic works out, and that really tolerance was never going to be enough, because tolerance doesn't deliver on that important act of recognition. It still says it's legitimate to deny my identity. Okay, we're not going to send you to prison for being black, but we're not going to treat you as an equal human being. That sounds really bad to us. That's racism. Right. Transpose that into the realm of sexual politics, and you get the sort of the same kind of.
Certainly,
we understand the dynamic.
I think when we think more critically of these things, we can understand where people are coming from, even if we have almost polar opposite views of and preconceptions and preconditions of what the world is and how we ought to live within it. But sometimes I think in retrospect, whether we're historians or philosophers, theologians, we can sometimes tend to impute a lot more reason and critical thought to the development of things than was actually there. Sometimes things just happen. And I'm curious, about your interaction with Charles Taylor's view of the social imaginary, because I think that's a helpful explanation or a concept to demonstrate how people think and act within the world. It's not always as if we're sitting around as analytic philosophers and thinking in terms of syllogisms on what we're going to eat for lunch or who we're going to associate with. But culture works in sometimes a much more nebulous way.
Yeah, Taylor's, the concept of the social imaginary is in some ways it's difficult to tie down, but it's a very useful concept. And essentially what Taylor's getting at there is the fact that most of us, if not all of us at some level, as you say, we don't interact with the world by always reasoning from first principles. We actually have a lot of intuitions that maybe we've never even consciously thought about at all. I mean, I use the example in class with the students. I say, if I look out the window and I see an old lady being beaten up by a gang of thugs, I don't need to reflect on whether that's a good or a bad thing. If I need to do that, we have a word for those people. They're called sociopaths. Typically, right. I instinctively react. Why? Because I intuit the world in a certain way where young people shouldn't beat up old people. That applies, I would say, the commitments of a lot of people to the theory of evolution would be a good example. You ask most people, certainly most people in Britain, do you believe in evolution? They'll say yes. If you then say to them, can you explain to me the genetics that needs to be true in order for it to work? They'll say, oh, no, no, no.
Right.
It's just that there's an intuitive sense to the idea that, hey, Truman and a monkey look quite similar. There must be a connection between the two somewhere. Yeah. So a lot of the way we live is intuition. And I would say it's the same with a lot of morality. When you think about the language that was used surrounding the gay marriage debate or even the transgender debate, this idea that it's bad to stop people loving each other. I just instinctively feel that it's bad to do that. Why shouldn't Bruce Jenner be Caitlyn? If that's what he really feels inside, to use Thomas Jefferson's phrase, you know, he's not picking my pocket or breaking my leg.
Precisely.
Why should I stand in his way of doing that? So the social imaginary is really Taylor's way of getting at how elite ideas somehow become the intuitions of every man and every woman on the street. How it happens can be different in different times and different places. But there is this kind of percolation down from the elites into the into people like us, the ordinary people.
Right.
I would say television does a lot of it.
One of the tremendous
things that I'm sure is that Will and Grace, the sitcom, played a much more important role in changing attitudes to gay marriage, for example, than any argument put forward by a continental philosophy seminar at a university. I remember reading my friend Robbie George's book, What is Marriage? And, you know, to me, it's the most brilliant defense of marriage. I doubt that it persuaded anybody to change their mind precisely because it's an argument and not a narrative or an aesthetic or something that's really getting at the intuitions of those who read it.
Absolutely. You know, that we're going to get to some more philosophers and more propositions and thought that explain how that came to be. I'm fascinated, especially we get into the next section. And perhaps we can also come back to that notion of the church seeking to argue on aesthetic or emotive points, which can be extremely dangerous because right now, you know, the gay marriage debate, which is pretty much a done deal, it's over.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But if you want to make those arguments, the culture is going to win the aesthetic or the emotive point. But before we conclude part one, I was curious about how these longstanding cultural institutions and better yet, just ideas that have been entrenched, the way people used to think about the world and how it operated. If there's going to be, in the progressive mindset, progress or change, then you have to tear these things down and replace them. You have to subvert them somehow. And then Philip Reeve introduces this notion of the death work. Can you explain that to us and what the significance of that is for our discussion?
Yeah. Well, two things there. One, Philip Reeve makes the point that culture, and by culture, he typically means the ways in which values are transmitted from generation to generation. He's not talking about pop culture. He's talking very specifically about the mechanisms by which values are transmitted from generation to generation. He says, we live at a unique time because in almost all other epochs of history, the elite, the cultural elite, have seen it as their task to pass on the wisdom of the previous generation to the next, sometimes with modifications, but by and large, the emphasis has been on continuity rather than break. We live at a time, he says, where the cultural elites are committed to the iconoclasm of the values of the past, and that manifests itself in various forms, and they do this in various ways. And one of the ways, he says, is this death work idea where you take that which was sacred to a previous culture and you sort of flip it on its head. the most obvious example, and it's a rather tasteless one. I hope that the audience will sort of bear, you know what I'm going to talk about.
It's art, Carl.
Art. And Andres Serrano's notorious work from the mid-1980s, Piss Christ, which is a crucifix submerged in a bottle of Serrano's own urine. And for Reef, that's an extreme but a great example of a death work, that you have something there that was sacred that has been made dirty, ridiculous, has had its authority stripped from it. He has, I think, this memorable phrase where he says, the sacramental has been turned into the excremental.
Right.
But he would also point to other works, the literature of James Joyce, for example, where Bible verses, sacred themes are picked up and really subtly mocked. I would say, I don't think Reef points to this, but I would say it, in some ways satire can be like a death work in that it makes the traditional authorities look ridiculous. So the way that the, what he calls the anti-culture, the iconoclastic culture that really wants to make everything new, is able to sort of shape the social imaginary is often through these cultural artifacts that deliberately play with the signs of the previous culture in a way that sort of makes them mean the opposite of precisely that which they were intended originally to mean, or the opposite function to that which they were originally meant to have.
Precisely. And we don't see this everywhere. Sometimes it's just a cheap laugh, but even in meme culture that we find in social media and Twitter and whatnot, we can find something, you know, if the first lady comes out in a green dress, the next thing you know, that's the green backdrop for a green screen. You're going to impose anything and everything on top of that. Sometimes it's just for a laugh, but I mean, there's an aspect of the death work and that anti-culture, the anti-culture at work as well. And it works itself out in various ways. This isn't necessarily, now this is an intellectual idea we're talking about. We're conceptualizing this anti-culture, but at the same time, you know, people on the street get it. They know it. They're engaged in it. This is part of real life.
Yeah. And it's these things I think have a bigger impact on most of us than the heavy tomes do. Most of us, we're not reading heavy books about deconstruction. You know, heavy books about critical race theory. We're catching the sound bites. We're seeing the murals. We're getting the, as you say, the memes, these kind of things. And these shape our intuitions.
Especially, yeah. And then when the algorithms of our various social media outlets, which are ostensibly amoral, I should say, not immoral, but there's an aspect of immorality there too.
Yes.
All they're seeking to do is to promote attention, and they end up oftentimes funneling us towards the things that we desire, and then starting slowly and incrementally to influence behavior in that regard. And it becomes dangerous in many ways. We don't see other viewpoints. We get changed. Now, in part two, you start to address, I thought this is perhaps for me the most fascinating section of the book, even though all of it holds together and coheres and is dependent on the rest of the subject. But we start speaking about the foundations of the revolution, particularly with Jean-Jacques Rousseau and Romanticism, as they bring in different understandings of human selfhood. I wonder if you could speak a bit about Rousseau, perhaps the most influential Genevan, and some of his impact. Now, that's going to be highly offensive to a lot of people that are listening. You can see some of my Calvin in the back, but if we're asking, you know, who's influenced culture, yes, Calvin, and he's done an enormous amount, but Rousseau is really kind of winning the day at the moment.
Yeah, in some ways, we're all kinds of the sons and daughters of Rousseau today. Mm-hmm. Rousseau's is important. I mean, essentially, he's the guy who says that it's society that screws you up. Yeah, to sort of rather simplistically boil his ideas down, he's the man who essentially says, you know, it's culture that perverts us. It's culture that makes us compete with each other. It's culture that makes us envious and jealous and angry. All of these things come from the fact that we live together as social beings in a culture. And I don't think he ever uses the term, but his thought experiment is of the noble savage. If we could just go back to the individual roaming the plains, not competing with anybody, not having to pretend to be something he isn't, then he's the ideal man. And for Rousseau, by the way, he was a man. He was a bit of a misogynist. Mary Wollstonecraft took him to task for that. But
he can't intersect everything.
But he's in some ways the intellectual origin of the idea of expressive individualism, that I am most authentically me when I am able to express outwardly that which I feel I am inwardly. Now, Rousseau is a million miles away from Bruce/Caitlyn Jenner, but you can see the trajectory that leads from one to the other. That yes, when Bruce Jenner says, you know, I've been a woman trapped in a man's body, when he uses that language of I've been living a lie and I finally I'm really me, that's the language of authenticity. And it's Rousseau that really sets up the play for that.
Yeah, it's the culture that would be oppressing and trying to conform Bruce Jenner into something that he isn't, ostensibly.
Yes, yeah. It's the whereas, you know, for Reef's medieval peasant, the external world is actually that which provides you with your identity. The way to be at home is to learn the rules of the culture and to fit in. In this more egalitarian Rousseau kind of world, no, the way is to try to make society free me up or get out of the way as much as it can.
Yes.
So I'm free to be myself in the open, outwardly, that which I feel to be inwardly.
Yeah. So in many ways, the culture, if it's a bad culture, and most of them are, according to him, then that's the problem. And that needs to be destroyed and changed. You know, then we see with Percy Bysshe Shelley and William Blake, somewhat of a turning of that romantic attention to society and culture as oppressive, but particularly in relation to the Christian sexual ethic and the sexual code within the culture. How did they start to, I don't know if we'd call it iconoclastic, I guess it is of sorts, but how did they go to attack kind of the dominant Judeo-Christian sexual code in society?
Yeah, well, towards the end of the 18th century, we start to see popping up this increasingly petulant criticism of the idea of lifelong faithful monogamy. It sounds weird to the modern ear, but there were those like William Godwin, who was Percy Shelley's second father-in-law, argued that monogamy actually leads to prostitution. Monogamy was, these guys genuinely believed that monogamy created social problems, that really human beings should be sexually free. And it was this that fascinated me, because I was thinking, you know, we tend to think of the campaign against marriage, traditional marriage, as a relatively recent thing. You know, it was invented by the LGBTQ people or something. In actual fact, it goes right the way back to the end of the 18th century, where you're starting to get pressure building from the elite in society for the overthrowing of the institution, which of course also involves the overthrowing of traditional Christianity, because the institution that maintains the institution of marriage is the church. So with Shelley and Blake, you start to get this push against traditional sexual mores, specifically monogamous marriage. And the genius of Shelley and Blake, of course, is they're doing it in an artistic form. Blake's Songs of Innocence and Experience are deceptively childlike in their meter and the way they're presented. They're sort of catchy, but the philosophy of some of those poems is pungently anti-traditional marriage and anti-Christian. In one poem, he talks about, it's a poem really about syphilis, and he talks about the marriage hearse. You know, he uses the language of the funeral to describe the marriage.
Wow.
In another poem, The Garden of Love, he talks about priest in black gowns who are walking their rounds and binding with briars my joys and desires. Who are the people who are stopping me achieve my authenticity in that kind of Rousseau sense? It's the church. It's the priests. It's the policemen of religion who are making me inauthentic because they're not allowing me to act upon my desires. And I think the genius of Romanticism was it carried this into artistic forms.
Yeah.
And artistic forms inevitably have a greater impact because they pull on the heartstrings and they have a broader appeal than tedious political tomes written by Godwin, for example. Who reads Godwin's Political Justice these days? Nobody. Who reads Blake and Shelley? Well, anybody who wants a decent smattering of English literature is going to be reading those guys.
Right. Yeah, I really regret that Shelley probably wrote my favorite poem, Ozymandias.
That chapter I enjoyed writing the most because I love the romantics, even though I, obviously can't go with them on this issue. They just wrote beautiful poetry.
Yeah, they knew what they were doing. They're good artists. Yeah, you know, it's tremendous. You know, you start to move. Obviously, we can't talk about everything and work through every idea, but I'd be remiss. One, I should mention that there's a wonderful comparison between Rousseau and Augustine, and an interesting point that Anne Hartle notes in her scholarship comparing Rousseau as intentionally responding to Augustine's views on what it means to be human and to have a human nature. But I really love to speak with you about Marx because whenever, I mean, I can't, I try not to read Twitter too much, but I can't even open the Twitter feed without seeing some charge of somebody being a Marxist, right? It's everywhere. Right? Now, basically, if you don't agree with me, then you must be a Marxist, race theorist. But honestly, though, how does Marx, you speak of quite a bit in this section on the emergence of plastic people.
Yeah.
Now, speaking of Nietzsche, Marx, and Darwin, but there's a tremendous amount we can speak on Nietzsche, but Marx in particular.
Yeah.
When he's speaking of this class struggle, how does this, in many ways, kind of just lay an epistemological? It lays an intellectual bedrock that's starting to really come to light now, presently.
Yeah, I think there are a couple of things that are important about Marx in that context. One, along with Nietzsche and Darwin, I think he's important for weakening, subverting, undermining the notion of human nature. The Romantics could kind of get away with what they were doing. Rousseau could get away with what he's doing because he did assume that there was a common human nature we all shared that had a sort of intrinsic moral structure to it. What you get with Darwin, Nietzsche, and Marx is the abolition of that idea, particularly with Marx and also with Nietzsche as well. But human nature becomes a construct of the dominant class in order to naturalize and normalize the moral structures that it needs to preserve its position of power, which is in some ways, touching on critical race theory. This is exactly. The idea there that, we want to talk about human dignity. No, you're really talking about the white man's notion of human dignity,
right.
You're universalizing your particular class or race interest. So we see that kind of logic flowing through to the critical theory of today. So that's one important point about Marx, that he's part of this general onslaught on the notion of human nature as a stable, transcendent, intrinsically moral concept.
Yeah.
Secondly, he makes history, he makes all things political. When Marx says, human beings are fundamentally defined by their economic relations to other human beings, what he does is he makes everything becomes economic and everything therefore becomes political. So as we think of today's society where, it sometimes strikes me as odd that the most private of human activities, sexual intercourse, has become one of the most pressing issues of public policy of our day.
Right.
Why has the intimately private become the explicitly public? Well, Marx is part of that story because for Marx, there is no private. Everything is political. You see this again, you probably see this on Twitter, but people say that's a personal opinion. Ah, no, the personal is political.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of view is only possible in a world that Marx has had a significant role in shaping in terms of how we understand all of human activity, political activity. So there's that element of Marx. And then thirdly, the element of struggle, that history is about overcoming oppression. And also, oddly, in doing that, he makes the traditional losers of history into the heroes and the winners. It's the poor, the dispossessed, the marginalized that become the heroes for Marx, not the great men, the powerful men. No, it's the underdogs, it's the underclass. And that, I think, plays strongly into our modern egalitarian intuitions. We have an instinct for the underdog. We don't like to see people being picked on and bullied by the powerful and the strong. So Marx's idea there resonates powerfully with part of the way we as modern Western liberal democratic people intuit the world around us. Wow. So those are the areas where I would say Marx is, you know, he's not solely responsible for the way we think, but he's a powerful theorist of some of the ways we now think and intuit the world.
Right. Before I ask my question, I just want to point out that I'm an American and have you naturalized yet? But well, we were the underdogs, and I just want to let you know that in case you didn't know that the country you live in, we revolted.
we're recording some weeks before the presidential election. All I can say is whoever wins on November the 10th, I will still be able to take pride in my head of state.
You're right. Is Boris Johnson still in charge? No,
he's not the head of state.
I know.
Don't talk about her children. It may change in the near future. That one.
Well, she has one less. They disowned one of them, but you know, that's another issue. You know, it's interesting on Marx and his theory and how, I mean, his ideas. How many people have lived and died by his ideas in the last 100 years? It's hard to fathom. In terms of the consequences of Marx's ideas and how different people have taken them and you put them to use. But one thing his theory could not explain as a glaring hole was the notion of he needed the proletariat to have some sort of political self-consciousness. They needed to become aware in order that they might realize that they're oppressed or that the ways in which the bourgeois are taking advantage of them and then they needed to revolt. But he did not, as far as I understand, and as you describe in the book, did not explain how that would come about. And we're seeing, I think now, I'd love to talk and ask you about Gramsci, if you'd like to fit this in, but we're seeing in some ways how critical race theory is in a way kind of the tool that now, as it's weaponized or used in various ways through the media and through education, in a very aesthetically pleasing ways often, is filling that gap in a way, explaining to people, to the underclass, the oppressed people, and showing to them how they're oppressed because they didn't realize it before. But now the critical race theory is explaining to them these things so that they then can revolt against the powers that be.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're absolutely correct. The lacuna in Marx's theory is how do you get the working class to understand their predicament. And, I think there's been no class has been more disappointing to Marxists than the proletariat, the heroes of the story. Mm. And one of the ways you mentioned the name of Gramsci, what Gramsci essentially does is say, to put it in kind of Marxist terminology, we don't need to seize the means of industrial production. We need to seize the means of cultural production.
Oh, yeah.
We need to take over the schools. We need to take over the law courts. We need to take over the universities. We need to get our people in these places so that they can shape the minds of people at a foundational level. We're not looking, if you like, to form militant trade unions, go out on strike, blow capitalism apart by that kind of thing. We're looking to transform the culture as a means of transforming the consciousness of people within the culture. Mm-hmm. And you're correct. I would say, you know, critical race theory. I would also say queer theory.
Sure.
Is another branch.
All forms of critical theory. Yeah.
Yeah. They're right. Predicated on that basic idea. And that means, of course, that the political struggle moves into realms that one might not have expected. You know, my grandfather was a trade unionist, lifelong socialist. For him, political struggle was going on strike. But now political struggle might be the policing of language. It might be pursued through the law courts in a way of dismantling what are seen as oppressive structures. So the whole political game shifts from really industrialization to culture.
Sure. And even more so, it doesn't even have to be explicit education, but the cultural products, the forms of cultural production versus, the means of production in an economy. You're exactly right. Gramsci was so prescient in kind of a depressing way.
Yeah, yeah.
But as you mentioned earlier, the effectiveness of will and grace in shifting the culture, you know, I listened to for other reasons, for nonprofit reasons, I listen to a podcast which is hosted by a woman named Joan Gary. She's tremendous in terms of her insight and understanding into how nonprofits work and whatnot. But she's a lesbian activist. She used to be an executive at Showtime, and they had and even apart from that, had been at work in various gay and lesbian organizations seeking to find the representation in the media. Because even 20 years ago, they explicitly knew, and I'm not just talking about the news, but they understood that if you could get and normalize certain behaviors and identities in movies, in television shows, in all of these other things, award shows, you name it, then that over time would win the culture and instruct people that they would, you know, their barriers to the oddities of these things would go down, and they would start to change their opinion. And they were right. In many ways, that's kind of Gramsci's idea, that's the way that change happens. It's through education, not necessarily in explicit forms always, but in these ideas, they have consequences.
And Rod Dreher, in his new book, Live Not By Lies, articulates this notion of soft totalitarianism, that we now have these very progressive political causes allied with very powerful corporate multinational organizations that can really tilt you or nudge you to think in certain ways. I won't say in order to survive, but certainly in order to enjoy the things you want to enjoy. You know, it's very interesting the way that, you know, cultural Marxism is a cheap term of abuse, really. Yeah. And it's used inappropriately 99% of the time. But there is such a thing as cultural Marxism. And I think that some of the phenomena we see now do conform to the criteria one would use for defining it.
Yeah, I agree. One important thing I think that's helpful is to speak of the LGBTQ plus movement.
Yes.
People might hear that and think they either might roll their eyes, because the letters keep increasing, but that's part of the point, that there have been more identities and more notions that have been added to this. Yeah. Coupled with all of this is this notion of intersectionality. I would encourage you to read the footnotes. I'll try to have links to the appropriate articles that you cite. But intersectionality is an extremely important subject on this matter. You end up with these tensions within these different identities. You would imagine that gays and lesbians would join hands and fight common battles, and they have in the past. But then they come to realize that lesbians also have the second factor of being female, and therefore the men who are gay don't have to deal with the same kind of cultural issues that women do, who are both women and homosexual. Then we start to add some other different intersectionalities to the mix. It gets rather complicated rather quickly, but I'd love for you to speak about the T in the equation, because it's kind of a monkey wrench in the way that the movements have progressed.
The sort of short story is the L, the G, and the B, lesbians, gays, and bisexuals, all depend upon an assumption of a gender binary. They assume the importance of biological sex. So a gay man is somebody who is sexually attracted to a male body. A lesbian is a woman who is attracted to the female body. Bisexual is somebody who can swing either way, but the identity of the body is still important. That's what makes them bi. The Q and the T are different on that front, in that I think with what you have with queer and transgender theory, you really have a press to abolish the idea of the importance of biological sex for identity, period. And so the Q and the T are inherently highly fluid, if not real destabilizing forces within the alliance. And this is emerging just last week. I have a little post coming up on it the next day or two at First Things. Just last week, a gay man in the UK wrote an article on the Unheard website saying that he was withdrawing his support for Stonewall because Stonewall was pressing transgender ideology and was telling him as a gay man that because he was not attracted to the body of a woman who was claiming to be a man, he was therefore transphobic.
Yeah.
So you get a little taste there. It starts to get a bit weird. And sometimes you have to read these paragraphs two or three times to follow exactly what's going on. But the Q and the T are essentially anarchic. I think the game of queer theory and the game of transgender theory is not to establish something as normative in the way that the L, the G, and the B assume the gender binary is normative. It's to destabilize everything. It really is a very nihilistic is perhaps too, well, I would say it's probably the wrong word. It's not too strong a word. It may be the wrong word, but it's an anarchic movement. And it is starting to put real pressure on the LGBTQ movement as a whole, as this article by, I think it's a guy called Johnny Best over at Unheard indicates.
Yeah, I think that is tremendously, I think that's eye-opening for a lot of people, because you can assume that there is some sort of monolithic movement that might be opposed to traditional Christian values. Now, if we boil it all down within a biblical worldview, there's the kingdom of God, and then there's the kingdom of this world. So in that sense, there is a very clear, sharp antithesis. We can look at things that simple if we need to, and it's often good to do that on occasions. But we also need to speak the truth in love. We need to understand our conversation partner's position and to get at it in a very, respectful and thorough way, not caricaturing people. But that's the issue there with the transgender, the queer and the transgendered position, that their own philosophical presuppositions in many ways destabilize the necessary preconditions for gays, lesbians, and bisexuals to begin with. And that is very complex. It's hard to get our minds around, but in a sense can also be encouraging, I think, for the Christian apologist and the cultural apologist to understand this opposition to the kingdom of God and to the church is not as stable as it might seem.
No, it's ultimately a rather incoherent one. I mean, it remains to be seen how it develops. But the alliance is really built on the fact that the enemy of the enemy is my friend. There's not an awful lot that really connects the L to the G, as you indicated at the start. There's not a lot that binds these separate elements together. And as the enemy, i.e. heterosexual, white, male culture, declines, I think the alliance itself will turn in on itself. It will be destabilized because the external pressure will not be sufficient to keep it together.
Yeah, it's pointed out in your book, as well as I'm reading Cynical Theories. I fail to remember the author's name. Perhaps you know it off the top of your head, but that's another very popular book that Amazon recommended to me based on my other reading. It knew that I would like this. And it does point out that often humorously people, try to carry intersectionality to its logical conclusion, which would be the individual. Every single person is their own unique combination of all individual factors. Nevertheless, identity is being found in groups, however small and narrow slice they are. So there's this tension between the one and the many, I think would be interesting for people to consider and to think about. But in conclusion, I most of all would like to leave people with some thoughtful, statements or at least movement forward, how the church might interact with these ideas and how we might move forward. This is the application part of our sermon, Carl, if you don't know. we mentioned earlier the aesthetic driven logic and ways in which the church has sought to combat these issues in the past might ultimately prove unfruitful and self-defeating. How would you recommend that we do seek to engage these ideas, to offer the hope of the gospel to people in Christian charity, but yet in an uncompromising way, trying to deliver this message in love, but also in faithfulness?
Yeah, it's a tough question. My first response would be, the first thing to do is we need to understand the culture in which we're operating so we know precisely what we're up against. Secondly, there's a sense, I mean, you and I, we're OPC guys. You know, I want to say, well, yeah. Secondly, the other thing is we carry on doing what we're doing. We keep preaching the gospel. We keep administering the means of grace.
Right.
But I think that needs to be backed up with a strong sense of community. One of the things that most struck me about Rosaria Butterfield's writings and her conversion and her move from being part of the LGBTQ to being the wife of a Reformed Presbyterian pastor, that's got to have been one of the most dramatic turnarounds in history, I would think, as a conversion.
Is although how much community... you and I are pretty queer in the older use of the term.
I guess so. But I think community is important. And what I'm a historian, so the question I'm always asking is, has the church been in this situation before? Obviously, there are aspects of the modern world that are unique. The internet, globalization, there are all kinds of elements of a modern culture that make life very different today to even what it was 50 years ago. But we do have certain analogy with, I think, the church in the second century. Church in the second century was marginal, was regarded as very marginal. It was seen as, it was little understood. It was regarded as immoral. Hey, they eat body and blood. They have brothers and sisters married. Wow, this is immoral stuff. And it was also seen as seditious. Jesus is Lord. Well, where does that leave Caesar? Are you meeting together to plot against the emperor?
Right.
The church responded, I think, in a number of ways. And one of them was, it was a strong community. It also didn't really, if you read the Greek apologists, they didn't really adopt a culture war mentality so much as a leave us alone, we'll be good citizens to the extent that we are able to be good citizens.
They were pilgrims. They understood the Exodus narrative and the lessons of Hebrews. And that doesn't mean just to ball up in a hole and have no interaction with culture, but we have to have a different mindset, like Colossians 3, 1 through 4. Set your mind on the things in heaven, the things above.
Yeah. So I think the church needs to recapture something of that. We need to be a strong community, and we need to be good citizens to the extent that we can. The second century, they wouldn't sacrifice to Caesar as a god, but they would serve in the Roman army.
Or pay taxes, yeah.
They paid their taxes.
Sure.
I think we need to capture something of that. I already see some of that in Europe, but secularization in Europe was a longer process. We've been further along in that process. In America, it's happened really rather rapidly. The church has been shunted to the margins, or is being shunted to the margins, at breathtaking speed. So we've not had a chance to get used to the fact that we don't own the country anymore. And the danger in that kind of moment is we just get angry, we just get combative, we launch our forces at the Battle of Frankenhausen and we get totally wiped out. Yeah, that's the kind of temptation.
Yeah.
I would say, no, it's time for thinking about what it means to be the church in a hostile culture, what it means to be a good Christian citizen in a hostile culture, what it means to be a community. The LGBTQ was successful because it was a community. These people loved each other and looked after each other.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe there's something there the church can learn from.
Yeah, and I think we also need to expand our notion of the church to true Catholic notion, small c Catholic, but also the global notion of the church, the universal church. And, I no doubt people may see this interview and say, oh, great, we've got two white guys in a splinter denomination, coming from basically, you and I have differences in many regards, but in the grand scheme of things, we're... we're neighbors, even though we come from different countries in terms of our heritage. We have the very almost identical worldviews. I mean, that's just a fact. And so therefore, it could be seen, well, what do these two bozos have anything to add to this conversation? Perhaps, and I don't know for sure, but perhaps a recovery or a true and honest understanding of ecclesiology can help us, that we're not just a community in our local zip code. But we as a church, yes, it's important to emphasize local churches. We can't live without them. We need to be embodied. We need to be a church in our local area and community. But we're also a spiritual body throughout the world and throughout the ages that transcends socio-political, cultural, geographical differences. And if we remember those things, I think that truly is a promising way in which the church can move forward. amidst the challenges that the world presents. And they might be different from region to region, but if we lose sight of that, of the church as a whole, I think we start to flounder a bit.
Yeah, I couldn't have put it better. I think that's excellent. Mm. I was chatting to a Roman Catholic recently and I asked him, hey, what do you think about the decline of your church in America? And his comment to me was interesting. He said, well, as Catholics, we're brought up to think of the church worldwide. He said, so, well, it's depressing. He said, I don't lie awake worrying about it because I'm always thinking of my church as worldwide.
Yeah.
Easier to do that when you just have, if you like, the one denomination worldwide.
True.
But I thought, well, there's something interesting there that, yeah, I do tend to think rather denominationally, rather nationally. I need to expand my ecclesial imaginary, if you like, to intuit the church as a global phenomenon. Yeah. So I think you put it beautifully.
Well, I don't know about that, but I think, yeah, just thinking about that, we need to live our ecclesiology. I always love meeting and speaking to our ecumenical friends, as we have fraternal delegates at the General Assembly, et cetera. And you know, even though, you know, in large measure, these are also very small denominations in other countries, it broadens your horizons. It broadens your view. And so often we have a very, I think, parochial view of the church, and we need to expand on this. So I appreciate you interacting with so many ideas and also sharing. I think that's one thing I love about you so much, Carl. You're a friend to many. You have principles. You don't compromise on your ideas or your principles or your beliefs. But also, in a way, you're very generous in the way, in the people you speak with and the ideas that you entertain and converse. And the fact that you have so many good friends in a variety of faith traditions, I think that speaks for an important, I don't know, a position of your heart. And I think that as you model that, more of us could benefit. And I think the church, the Reformed Church as a whole, could benefit from entertaining these ideas, not out of fear for, you know, being changed or whatnot, but getting out there and interacting without, I don't know, this overly parochial stance.
Well, thanks. The Lord has given me a very blessed life. Mm. So thanks for that.
Yes, and we'll dwell in the house of the Lord. Surely goodness and mercy will follow us all the days of our lives, and we shall dwell in the house of the Lord forever with all of God's people. So thank you very much. This book is tremendous. Get a copy of it today. The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self, Cultural Amnesia, Expressive Individualism, and the Road to Sexual Revolutions, published by Crossway. Just get a copy. Everyone needs to have a copy. Read it. I'm not messing around. This is an important work, and we're going to be reading it many years from now, I trust. So thank you, Carl, for joining us today. Visit The Mortification of Spin online. You can visit Grove City College online as well and find out information about their programs. And, of course, we might as well promote the Orthodox Presbyterian Church, opc.org. You can send your hate mail there. If you please don't. Our church is very good, very faithful. But you can get a hold of us online at reformedforum.org, where you'll find information about all of our programs, our online free online courses on a variety of subjects, as well as ways to get in touch with us if you would like to converse. And I do want to thank everybody for listening. We hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.